calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. It seems that the White House is walking away from any sort of participation in policy with regard to fuel efficiency standards, fuel prices, the impact of fuel on the middle class, and those kinds of things. And I have to say, I'm in some ways of two minds about this. On the one hand, the reality is that oil is a diminishing resource. You put gas in your tank and spill a drop of oil on your hand and take a look at it, you're looking at a 300-million-year-old fossil. It's older than the dinosaurs. So, I mean, the whole idea of building a society on dinosaur bones or, you know, dinosaur tissue or something even older than dinosaur is kind of silly. So it seems to me a good idea that government have some sort of active or proactive even policy to keep that sort of thing, you know, to keep us from making that mistake, to keep us from walking off the edge of the cliff into, you know, past peak oil into a disaster, there's no more oil. Or to soften the transition from one energy technology to another. On the other hand, it also seems to me that that transition is most likely going to be promoted by increasing prices of fuel. So the price of gas goes up, the price of oil goes up, alternatives become more attractive, and the marketplace actually starts to work in that instance. On the third hand, that transition can be fairly abrupt, and it can be extremely painful to a lot of people, particularly those people in the middle class and the lower end of the middle class, working people who, an extra $10, $20, $30, $40 a week in gas expense and an extra $100, $200 a month in home heating expenses is enough to push them over the edge into bankruptcy, which now, of course, the Republicans have made much, much more difficult with their so-called bankruptcy reform. So it's a complex issue. And I thought that we would get Robert Garmong on. Robert is with the Ayn Rand Group. And why Robert's point of view is important, I think, is because the Ayn Rand's philosophy, her thinking, which created objectivism, which is what Robert's all about, in many ways led to the libertarian worldview and the Cato Institute, and which in many ways then contaminated or infected or those are negatives. What's the word? Influenced Republican thinking, conservative thinking, so to the point that a lot of modern-day Republicans are more libertarians or quasi-objectivists than they are, you know, old-fashioned conservatives. And I think it's important that we have this debate or this discussion. Robert, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Tom.
Good to have you back with us. Robert, I'm assuming that your take on this whole thing is that the government should simply have nothing whatsoever to do with this.
Well, I think that the government should not be involved in trying to regulate prices or control prices or modify what the market does. And part of what you said in your introduction, I think, is spot on, and that is the only efficient way to allow for the market to identify the best, most efficient use of resources is precisely the policy of hands-off. Let people figure out their own problems in their own best way.
Well, and however, the flip side of that is what happened in Europe. I lived in Europe back in the 1980s, in the mid-80s. I lived for a year in Central Europe, in Germany. And most, in fact, all, as far as I know, all of the European governments at that time were throwing about a $3.50 to $4 per gallon tax on gasoline. And as a result of that, the average German was consuming, and they were driving all over the place, by the way. You know, you get on the Autobahn, you go 130 miles an hour if you want, and I have, and it was great fun. But the average German consumes one-seventh as much fossil fuel in the course of a year as the average American. And I can tell you their lifestyle isn't all that significantly different from ours. It's not like, you know, they're only taking showers every other month or something. And that was the result of direct government intervention. The government saying, hey, look at this. Germany doesn't have any oil. We've been through this. One of the reasons why Rommel was sent down into Africa was to try and capture oil. I mean, Hitler's machine was running out of oil. They were terrified of that prospect. Germany had been through that before. We've got no oil, so let's put a high tax on it, and that will cause people to conserve. That will cause people to buy vehicles that get 40, 50, 60 miles per gallon. I drove a Volkswagen station wagon, a diesel that got about 50 miles to the gallon, and it was a full size station wagon. And people actually turn off their cars at stoplights and things, you know, to save gas. Why? That is government intervention, and it worked fairly well.
Well, and Tom, I want to get back to another point that I think is working on a deeper level here. Our problem is not resource scarcity at this point. Our problem is not that there's not enough oil. That's maybe paradoxical to say, but our reserves, in fact, right now are at very high levels. Our reserves of crude oil are at very high levels, and we're continually finding more and more sources of oil. We're not in any danger of running out of oil, notwithstanding certain real risks such as there may be supply or demand shocks out of China and so on.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting we're running out, although I think that we're probably hitting the Hubbert peak. But it is a non-renewable resource, and over time, you know, it will reach the point where it's going to get more and more expensive. It's so expensive that it takes more energy to get it out of the ground than is left in there. I mean, that's what happened to the oil wells in Pennsylvania, and then in New Jersey, and then in New York State, and then in Ohio, and then in Michigan, and, you know, as it kind of crept across the country as we marched west finding more oil because we used up all the oil we had in the East Coast.
Except the one ultimate resource that you're forgetting is the human mind, and we're continually finding new and more efficient ways to get oil out of old, previously tapped fields, and I think that process will continue.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And in fact, on this program many times have said, you know, I think that Julian Simon, as much as I disagreed with many of the things he said, he was kind of the paragon of the right. He's deceased now. The guy who had the bet with Paul Ehrlich about, you know, where the basket full of resources of zinc and metals were going to end up. You know, he said, you know, the ultimate resource is the human mind. I agree with that. However, part of that human mind is we the people in the form of government saying, okay, we're going to put our minds together and figure out how to anticipate this and deal with it before it becomes a crisis, or so that it can't be used by a small number of corporate moguls to basically screw everybody.
Well, the ultimate solution is not for the great minds at the government to figure out the problem, because the great minds of the government, even if they are truly great minds, don't have anywhere near the collective wisdom of the marketplace, and the marketplace will work things out. Now, if you want to know...
Well, let me pause you right there, Robert. Why is it then that in Europe they are not being as badly affected by this oil shortage as we are, because their great minds in their government had the foresight about 20, 30 years ago to slap what we at the time thought was an absurdly high tax on petroleum products?
Well, that is precisely the issue. The real price of oil and gas there are changing the same as they are here. The problem, the thing in Europe is that's a smaller percentage of what they actually pay for their gas, because
right,
they have $4 a gallon of taxes. Or
well, it's not just a smaller percentage. It's that if you're using 1/7 as much oil and gas as you were using before, and then there's a 10% variation in the price of that, that's 1/7 of 10%. That's, you know, that it becomes a very incrementally smaller change in terms of its impact on you. So,
but it puts you in a rather interesting position, doesn't it, Tom, to be making this sort of argument? Because what you're essentially saying is that in order to keep us from being hurt by $3 a gallon gas prices, we should be forced by government to be paying $5 a gallon.
I've been saying that for years. I've been saying that for years, Robert, ever since I lived in Europe. I looked around and said, hey, they've got a public transportation system that works. People ride bicycles. It works. People walk routinely everywhere they go. The city centers are vibrant. And why? Because at the end of World War II, they said, you know, the smart thing to do is to discourage the use of fossil fuels. And so they slapped this tax on them.
And so you're concerned about the impact on the poor. And I've been to graduate school. I know that a rise in prices can affect the poor.
I am concerned about it, because we've had lousy public policy in the United States for, you know, the last 100 years, the fossil fuel era, and our public policy has not set up a situation where we could anticipate this kind of thing, or where we did anticipate it. I think Jimmy Carter was arguably starting us down that road. Ronald Reagan came in and said, oh, no, we're, you know, get government out of that, and took the solar collectors, Carter's solar collectors, off the top of the White House. And because we've had lousy public policy up to this point, I think that we have an obligation to do something to the people who are playing the game by the rules. They're working hard every day, putting in their time, and they're going to be in deep trouble.
Well, I just want to point out that those are the people who are going to be hurt first and foremost if you adopt the sorts of policies that you're talking about, major increases in taxation on precisely the gallons of gas that it may take someone who is struggling for a living to get to work.
Well, I'm not suggesting a unidimensional response. I mean, what they did in Germany, for example, was they said, okay, we're going to tax gas at $4 a gallon of tax so that the price of gas is $5 a gallon, and we're going to put billions of dollars into building a public transportation system with buses and streetcars and trains that actually works and is efficient so that pretty much every German citizen is within two blocks of public transportation. Now, if you do both of those things at the same time, the impact on the poor is minimized.
Well, and
you would be opposed to either one, right?
I would be. I believe that it's up to people to decide for themselves, and I think people are much wiser than their elected representatives in determining how they want to live their lives. In America value our independence far more than that. We want to be able to drive our cars, so we can. And I think that's a good thing.
I want to, therefore I can. Interesting philosophy. Tom in Minneapolis has a question for you, Robert. You mind taking a question from a caller?
Of course not.
Okay, Tom, you're live with Robert Garmong.
Hi, Robert. Hey, last time you were on, Robert, you asserted that capitalism is a political system. And I think this all boils down to honesty in language and accuracy in definitions. And we all know that capitalism is an economic system. And in a democracy, the economic system is subservient to the political system. Now, of course, you understand that, so you must elevate the economic to a political system, and therefore you say capitalism is a political system. So that's incorrect, and you know that. The first three words of the U.S. Constitution is we the people, not we the market.
Yeah.
So this is where
Tom, you got to make it a question. We've only got 40 seconds left. I'm sorry. I want Robert to have time to answer.
Yeah, Robert, you don't believe in the founding fathers and our document.
Okay.
Tom,
I got it. Robert, your response.
Well, I do think that capitalism is a political system and an economic system, and you cannot separate the two. When you try to separate the two, as you have, for instance, in China...
Wait a second. Capitalism is a political system. By what mechanism does capitalism allow for people to govern themselves?
Capitalism allows that by the simple mechanism of the protection of individual rights, including the right to property, which is what gives rise to the economics of capitalism.
But wait a minute. How do we govern ourselves through capitalism? By having a few corporations own our voting machines? Is that what you're talking about?
Capitalism means that you have the right to your own life, liberty, and property.
Right. But we've got to get together and do some things in common. We've got to have the police department, the fire department, the army. How does capitalism provide for that? It doesn't.
Well, capitalism, in my view, is a system in which the government exists only to protect individual rights. So police, army, courts, those are provided for under capitalism, but not the kind of welfare state that we have today.
But there's no mechanism to decide who those people are.
Sure, there is.
Robert, we'll have to carry this on the next time we talk. I appreciate you coming on with us today. Robert Garmong, Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. It's Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend.
And welcome back.
I'm not some daydream seller. I do not pretend.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 25 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number 1-866-889-8894, the place where smart people get their news. Bill in Salt Lake City on the line. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I was just going to mention that, isn't that something that Al Gore keeps getting beat up on? He got beat up on it during the election. Was that, I think it was in one of his books, perhaps, on the environment that he suggested?
Earth in the balance.
Pardon?
Earth in the balance, yeah. He suggested that we have, well, basically that we do what Europe did, which is throw significant funding into developing a public transportation infrastructure, and then once that's in place, so that the transition isn't brutal to people, it dramatically increase the tax on fossil fuels.
Okay. Because, because I know they keep bringing that up once in a while, you know, and...
Yeah, kick him around the head with it.
Yeah.
He was prescient. He was seeing the future.
Yeah, I think so.
And it didn't take a rocket scientist to see the future, by the way.
Right. Well, you know, that's the only
Nixon
thing I've
talked
been
about
able
this.
To, been able to figure is after 73, I keep thinking to myself, boy, if we'd have done something on that order back, you know, after we got over the embargo, in 30 years, I would think we could have stuck the money into renewables or, you know, research and development, that kind of thing. But that's my comment.
Yeah, okay, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. And in fact, you know, the reality is that Richard Nixon was talking about this. Jimmy Carter was talking about this. I mean, this is not... contrary to what the cons would have you think, you know, something that just snuck up and surprised George W. Bush. Oh, gee. And then Bush, you know, he gave his speech the other day and he said that, you know, we've never had an energy policy in the United States, you know, and now finally Dick Cheney has helped us come up with one. And so we got to get this through Congress. Completely forgets the reality of the comments that Jimmy Carter made back in July 15th, 1979.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
Never. And then about solar power?
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
20% of our energy. That's more than what we're getting from Saudi Arabia. We could have simply said to the madrasas, the Wahhabists, yeah, we're not going to give you any more money. Sorry. No need. We don't need to give you any more. We're not going to do it. Not going to go there. Sorry. If we had simply listened to Jimmy Carter. But no, Ronald Reagan came along and he said, okay, we're going to put an end to that. Carter is talking about things that might impair the profits of the oil companies. How dare he? After all, the oil companies helped put Ronald Reagan into power. And now we are suffering. We are, in so many ways, we are suffering the predictable consequences of Reagan's policies. Reagan's foreign policy. Reagan's domestic. Reagan's policy of taking apart unions and destroying the middle class. Reagan's policy, energy policies of making us entirely dependent upon oil, fossil fuels in particular, but oil, or in general, oil in particular. Ronald Reagan's economic policy of spending the government into bankruptcy so that he could say, oh, gee, look at that. The government's bankrupt. I guess we can't have Social Security anymore. Remember, it was Ronald Reagan who wanted to first do away with Social Security. It's a socialist program. Cornerstone of conservative thought. All right, there you go. And all, you know, the chickens are coming home to roost now. Ronald Reagan, when he came into office, no president had ever run our debt beyond $1 trillion. And Reagan ran it up to $3 trillion. He accumulated more debt than every president before him in two world wars and a civil war combined, even in the dollars of his day. And this year we're paying $160 billion in interest on that loan. 29 minutes past the...
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
My bills are all due, and the babies need shoes, but I'm busted.
Post-Reagan America, yes.
Cotton is down to a quarter a pound, and I'm busted.
Just taking us back to the Great Depression, that's all.
I got a cow that went dry, and a hen that won't lay. a big stack of bills that get bigger each day. The county will haul my belongings away. I'm busted.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. Truth in broadcasting for a change. Bill O'Reilly, Rush Limbaugh, all the big guns of the Reich are coming out now against Cindy Sheehan. Why would she be such a threat? O'Reilly, first of all, most recently saying that he's been vindicated, that he never slandered her, he never accused her of treason.
Heather O'Neill, New York City. I see the right-wing smear tactics have begun against Cindy Sheehan. Well, I don't know where you're seeing that. Not here. Ms. O'Neill, we've reported the story accurately and fairly. Al Negengast, Payson, Arizona. O'Reilly, the savaging of Mrs. Sheehan by you and Michelle Malkin is a new low for the factor. Both Michelle and I were respectful to Mrs. Sheehan, sir. You are distorting and perhaps lying about the segment.
Oh, yes. Call your listeners liars, Bill. That always works really well.
of such behavior,
well,
conduct,
I have to
rhetoric.
Say that she obviously does, because she's the lead story on Michael Moore's website.
Oh, Michael Moore. See, here's the... Now, Michael Moore puts Cindy Sheehan on his website, so now this is Cindy Sheehan's fault, number one. And number two, that assumes that there's something wrong with Michael Moore. I got to tell you, tell me where Michael Moore is the radical, please. I mean, I've seen his movies all the way back to Roger and Me. I've read his books. I don't get it where he's a radical. It seems to me that what Michael Moore is saying, in large part, is what most of America is saying. We'd like to have safe streets. We would like to have health care for all in the United States. We'd like to have a rational foreign policy. We'd like to be respected around the world again. We would like to have our lives not be controlled by big corporations. We would like to have some say in our government, in our governance. See, it's amazing. I mean, they as one of our callers pointed out yesterday, the right wing has been so effective in destroying the old real left, the communists and socialists, through the McCarthy era purges, that they were left with nothing but essentially the anti-Vietnam War movement in the 60s and 70s. So they said, oh, that's the lefties. And then it was the Democrats. Because the positions that we're taking on this program, this is why I call the program the radical middle, the positions that I take on this program, that we should have a national single-payer national health insurance program, like virtually every other advanced democracy in the world, certainly every other industrialized country in the world, that we should have reasonable, rational taxation policies that are progressive, that we should have foreign policy that serves the interests of the United States, not just a select few in the White House, and not just the political goals of the Bush administration. That we should have appropriate restraints on capitalism so that capitalism can be saved from itself. You know, there are those who say, I believe it was John Kenneth Galbraith said that Franklin Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself. It's true. Because, you know, absolutely unrestrained, what do you get? You get the Great Depression. You get Dickensian England. You get, you know, a crisis. So these guys on the Reich are now saying, oh, they're now labeling us who traditionally have been in the mainstream of American thought as the extreme left, the Michael Moore left. I'm sorry, we're not members of the CPUSA. I mean, it's not like they're not around anymore. I mean, yeah, okay, there is a Communist Party USA, but they're so marginalized, there's nothing there. So they can't pick on them. So it's the straw man thing. So they make up this big bugaboo. Here's the old Riley.
I'm on an almost daily basis, and she knows. I mean, Michael Moore isn't a subtle guy. Everybody knows where he stands. So, I mean, I think Mrs. Sheehan bear some responsibility for this, and also for the responsibility of other American families who have lost sons and daughters in Iraq who feel that this kind of behavior borders on treasonous.
Yeah, so, and then he says, oh, no, I didn't say that. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain, right? Pay no attention at all. And then Rush Limbaugh.
I mean, Cindy Sheehan is just Bill Burkett. Her story is nothing more than forged documents. There's nothing about it that's real.
It's not real.
including the mainstream media is glomming onto it. It's not real. It's nothing more than an attempt. It's the latest effort made by the coordinated left.
Yeah, in other words,
pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Just please pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. And why? Because they're all scared to death. Scared to death that Cindy Sheehan might once again tell the story that she told the Conyers Commission.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president. From the expose of the Downing Street memo and the conversations with George Bush from 1999, it seems like the invasion of Iraq and the deaths of so many innocent people were preordained. It appears that my boy Casey was given a death sentence even before he joined the Army in May of 2000.
Bush lied and humans died. The death of over 100,000 people on his hands so he could gain political capital. That, my friends, that is the man behind the curtain they don't want you looking at. That's the thing that they are terrified is going to come out. And so far, the mainstream media have been very good about not reporting that, about not going near that. And the cons are just desperately hoping that it stays that way. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Vicki in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Vicki, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I just want to say that every time I see Cindy Sheehan on TV or read some of her words, she chokes me up. She is the genuine, real deal, and that's what people like O'Reilly and Rush and Hannity are afraid of. She speaks truth to power. The other thing I wanted to bring up to you was I find it interesting that Bush can't, you know, spend, you know, be bothered with a moment of time on his vacation for this woman, yet he could fly to D.C. in the middle of the night on a Sunday night from Crawford to sign that Schiavo bill.
I mean, you know.
I want to get that theme out there, Tom. So
yes, that meme, you mean. Yeah, it's a good one, yeah. Thank you very much, Vicki. Yeah, well, if Bush can fly if Bush can fly from Crawford to Washington, D.C. to sign the Schiavo bill, why can't he show up? Well, here's Cindy Sheehan, by the way, his response to Bill O'Reilly and Michelle Malkin savaging her, calling her treasonous and a traitor.
I didn't even know Casey knew Michelle Malkin, you know, and I'm Casey's mother. I know him better than anybody else in the world, and I know Casey is up there, and Casey's saying, "You go, Mom," and he is just like saying, I can hear him going, George Bush did not know what he was going to unleash when he did this to me, you know, and I can't bring Casey back, and I wonder how often Michelle Malkin has sobbed on my son's grave. You know, did she come to his funeral? Did she sit up with him when he was sick, when he was a baby? You know, that to me, that is the most despicable thing. I can speak for my son, and I feel like it was a miracle that I got well yesterday. But, you know, I've been doing this for months, and I never get sick. I have the energy of 100 people, and I believe it's Casey and the rest of the people who have been killed so unjustly and so needlessly in this war. They're holding me up. I will never give up. I promise you that.
This is a woman who was a Catholic Sunday school teacher for 10 years, raised an Eagle Scout, and then saw George W. Bush send him to Iraq where he died. 1-866-889-8894. Spike in Easton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Spike, what's up?
Hey, gonzo greetings.
Thank you. I'll tell
you what, the whole vigil around the country for Cindy Sheehan was quite a success, at least here in the Lehigh Valley. in the city of Easton here, where we only have about 28,000 people, we had no less than 100 people out there with candles, standing out on Center Square with the War Memorial and the memorial where the Constitution or Declaration of Independence was first read.
Yeah, here in Portland, we had over 20 of them, and the average attendance seems to be, from what I've been able to figure out this morning, you know, contacting folks in the, on our morning program, seems to be around between 300 and 400 people. You know, some of them 500, 600, 700 people. I mean, they were just stretching for 6, 8, 10 city blocks at a time.
And nearby neighboring Bethlehem and Allentown both had hundreds at theirs also. And basically, the support from the people driving by was all positive. You got the maybe three idiots that had to yell obscenities in front of children. Great Christian family values for your Bush supporters there.
Yeah.
And but for the most part, people were very overwhelmingly giving us the thumbs up, honking. And it's great because I remember 2 years ago when I was an opponent of the war, you couldn't get people to go out and protest. You couldn't get people to agree with you. You know, people thought, well, if the news is telling us we should be going, then, you know, it must be true.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's great. It's great to see that the truth is starting to come out and the Americans are finally starting to wake up to what's really going on. I commend you and progressive radio shows who have been really talking about this issue for years, talking about Cindy Sheehan recently. And really, this all came together a lot because of shows like yourself.
Well, thank you, Spike. I appreciate it. Thanks for your kind comments. Wade in California on the line. Hey, Wade.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great.
Good. Quick question in regards to oil and the free market economy and everything else. Mm-hmm. I'm a believer in free market economy, but to me it only works when there's actual demand and not with concepts like utilities and oil and that sort of thing.
Right. They're monopolies, essentially.
Right, exactly. I mean, I was here, you know, when we had the electricity crisis, and because there were no regulations, because it was a free market, and it was totally privatized, we got totally screwed up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What do you think about that? I mean, my concept is, and it's happened in, you know, third world nations all over the world, where they privatize utilities, water, gas, that sort of thing, electricity, and as a result, they get totally hosed by these big corporations.
Yeah, it hasn't just happened in third world countries. As you point out, it happened, you know, right there in California. I mean, it's and in you know, nothing new to it, in fact.
Burn, baby, burn.
All right, this from Enron.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
You know, and then they continue, you know.
He just California. He steals money from California to the tune of
About Ken Lay here.
Can we rephrase that? Okay, he arbitrages the California market to the tune of $1 million a day.
And it goes on. It's,
if you took down a steamer, how long would it take to get it back up?
Oh, it's not something you want to just be turning on and off every hour.
See, this is a free enterprise.
Well, why don't you just go ahead and shut her down?
Why don't you just go ahead and shut her down? I mean, this is
taking all the money back from you guys? All the money you guys stole from those poor grandmothers of California?
Yeah, Grandma Millie, man.
Yeah, now she wants her f***ing money back for all the power you charged right up, jammed right up her.
We'll stop at that point. Anyhow, it's Enron. We got to, you know, it's just, what can be done about that? It's a tough one. It's a tough one. I think that, frankly, I think that, you know, regulation of utilities on the one hand, or going back to publicly owned utilities are the answers. Very simply.
Well, and I mean, you hit the nail on the head after World War II when all those European countries built, did the public transportation thing. We built highways. I mean, that to me is the, you know, most clear difference between how we both reacted to the same situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Wade, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Scott in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hey, I was just thinking, this point of view and see what you think. A lot of times I hear people calling the president a liar, you know, for either Iraq or 9/11 or whatever it is. And it seems to me that a person who believes the president's natural inclination is to come to his defense when there's a strong attack on him by calling him a liar. Wouldn't we gain some ground just by demonstrating that if you don't want to believe that he's a liar, that him and his cabinet are incompetent?
Yeah. Yeah, actually. I mean, those are your choices. Is he a liar or is he incompetent? He's given us the biggest deficit in history. He's given us the biggest trade deficit in history, the biggest debt in history. He's given us the worst, you know, not the worst economy in history, but, you know, pretty bad economy. Hasn't, you know, created minimal jobs. The jobs that have been created are not good jobs. We've lost several million manufacturing jobs. I mean, it's just, yeah.
It seems to me that, you know, by demonstrating
screwed up a war.
Right. It just seems to me that by demonstrating incompetence, you give they're his supporters, an acceptable way out. Because otherwise, their pride is such that if I was lied to by them, then there's something wrong with me. Whereas if he's incompetent, there isn't. And the other thing I want to get to real quick is how do we get to back to a point where you can have a conversation where somebody on the left or the right of an issue actually has a conversation and believes that what the other person says might be true, or it just seems now that one person on either side or the other automatically thinks that whatever the other side is saying has either been filtered through a progressive machine or a conservative machine, or worst case, it's just an outright lie.
Well, we need to go back to rational discourse in this country. It's one of the reasons why I have conservatives on this program from time to time to try and model that for folks. I think that it's really important that we acknowledge where we've been wrong and we push where we've been right and hold to what we believe in, and that the big danger is gotcha, my side, your side politics, where, you know, my side is right, your side is wrong, no matter what my side does, it's right, no matter what your side does is wrong, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, that kind of politics does not help this country, and that kind of, you know, just as a classic example of that kind of politics, consider these quotes, and these are quotes about a president of the United States committing troops it's about Bill Clinton committing troops to Bosnia, a war that was led by Wesley Clark, in which not one American died. Representative Tom DeLay, you can support the troops, but not the president. Joe Scarborough, well, I think it's just a bad idea. What's going to happen is they're going to be over there 15, 10, 20 years. Sean Hannity on Fox News, April 6, 1999. And this is a war in which not one American died, but just before it happened. Explain to the mothers and fathers of American servicemen that they may come home in body bags why their son or daughter have to give up their life. Where's Sean Hannity saying that now? See, that's the problem, and you've absolutely identified it. Gotcha politics. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. The truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. It's a blinding lie, baby, in all you. The truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. Don't need your lies.
Not something that the Bushies are fond of, and certainly they don't want Cindy Sheehan speaking out the truth. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was wondering if you're aware of one of the right-wing talking points being that Wilson did find that Iraqis were looking for uranium and that they also found uranium in Iraq. Have you heard that?
Well, certainly there was uranium in Iraq. It was under UN seal. It had been there for years and years. We knew it was there. We knew where it was. Now it has been dispersed because after the invasion, the guards, you know, were left. They were no longer being paid. They were no longer part of the Iraqi army. And so people looted it, didn't know that it was uranium, thought the containers were kind of cool. They could use them for water. They dumped out the uranium on the ground and took the containers home.
Oh, I see.
And so, there actually was uranium there. But, it was not uranium that could have been used for anything. You would have to have a significant technological infrastructure to use it, which we had destroyed.
I see. Well, I wanted to ask you also, is there a way to pass some legislation, like sort of antitrust legislation against a party that if it gets to a certain size, it has to break up?
I mean, it's not a bad idea.
I mean, if it starts to like, I'm not joking. I mean, maybe that's something that can be done.
It's called a ballot box, Logan. I mean, it's happened before. The Federalists imploded. The Whigs imploded. The Democratic Party has gone through two major transformations in the years it's been around. The Republican Party's gone through a couple as well. So I think that that's just part of the natural process of politics. Thanks for the call, though. Great to hear from you. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Tom, we had two pretty successful rallies within 10 miles of my house here. I went to the one in Eureka and...
The vigils last night, you mean?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, the standing with Cindy, the very precious lady. And almost everybody that went by was cheering us on and beeping horns and whatnot. But an interesting thing that our conversation was going through, our whole group of... see if Tom Hartman's famous Alice is here. Everybody wanted to meet Alice.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she wasn't up to being there last night.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, they all thought for sure she would be, she would have been.
I hope you passed along her best regards to people.
Oh, yes, I did. I confessed to being her next-door neighbor and buddy and all.
Yeah, okay. Great. Dave, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for the call. I'm glad to hear that everything went well and that you were able to show up. And good times were had by all, as it were. But most important, that the word is getting out. You know, things are changing in America. It's just, it is becoming so obvious that people are getting it. People are figuring it out. You know, these guys lied to us, and they lied to us for political gain. That's what makes it so heinous. It wasn't just that they lied to get the oil, because you could buy the oil. There's other ways to get the oil. It wasn't just that they lied to enrich Halliburton. They could have figured out some other way to enrich Halliburton. They needed a war in order to win elections, because no wartime president in the history of America has ever lost an election. That's what this was all about, and that's why it's horrific.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, friends, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We're tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Welcome back to our program. Our phone number toll-free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. Outside the United States, 503-248-0620. Jesse in Pittsburgh is on the line. Hey, Jesse, how are you today? What's on your mind?
Oh, great. Thanks, Tom. I have a question and a suggestion real quick.
Sure.
Since everyone knows news cable shows are business decision, and you have half of America who voted against Bush, why hasn't someone like a George Soros or someone else given us a news network that speaks the truth instead of Fox's smoke and mirrors? That's my first question.
Well, it's a good question, and I don't know the answer to it. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm just surprised. Do you know what I mean?
I know that Ted Turner had talked about trying to buy back CNN. And that it was just, you know, beyond him. The money was just beyond him.
Because there's so many wealthy Democrats that, you know, you just think that that's such a business, great business decision. We have half of America who can't get the news.
I think, Lisa, you perhaps may be underestimating the amount of money that would be necessary for this. I mean, NBC is in this big time. They're a large defense contractor. They own GE is a large defense contractor. They own MSNBC and NBC and like that. And you've got some very, very deep pockets out there. For somebody to come into it for political purposes is really rare and really expensive. I mean, and in fact, frankly, I think that when Rupert Murdoch came into this for political purposes, or some say for political purposes, that really, in fact, he came into it because he saw an opportunity to make money when he funded Fox Network. Fox Network only lost money for its first 4 years. And then they started making money. Now, you got Reverend Moon. He's still losing money with the Washington Times, but he's buying so much influence in Washington, D.C., that he's getting all these millions of dollars through the faith-based initiatives, that it's sort of paying off for him.
Well, I guess I'm coming at it at the demographic. I mean, you got half of America who tune in. You know, that's what I'm not going at it at the money. Of course, that's deep pockets you need, of course. But the second suggestion I have is you need to get the soundbite of Bush during the debates when he was asked what he would do if gas prices skyrocketed. And I guess I heard this on a talk show in Pittsburgh right before yours, and I guess he referenced, you know, don't forget who I am. I'm the oil guy, and if you want anybody in this situation, that's me. I'm the man, and, you know, all my buddies are in this business. So if you can find that soundbite, that would be fantastic.
Okay. Do you know which debate that was from, Jesse?
It is. Pardon me?
Do you know which debate that was from?
No, I heard it on a talk show before yours in Pittsburgh on the Lynn Collins show, and I don't. Yeah, and I can just hear him saying it. That's why I thought for sure it's out there, and I would love it if you played. That would be great.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jesse, for the tip. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, and thanks for holding there. Lisa DePasquale is with us. Lisa is with the Claire Booth Luce Policy Institute. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for having me again.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming back on our program again. It seems there is a concerted effort to...
I don't know if it's necessarily to smear a right to protest and to, you know, speak her mind, but now by her grief or by...
What's wrong with that?
Well, I think, Pat Buchanan, a conservative...
Which, if you haven't read, I strongly recommend. It's actually a very good...
The other things that she said, saying that, you know, America is not where that... Bush,
you know, I've never heard a clip of her saying that, Lisa. And I would have to imagine that if she actually said that, that you know, Hannity and all these other guys would be playing it over and over and over again on the radio. I've never heard a clip of her saying that.
Well, I got it from Michelle Malkin's website. The exact quote is,
therefore,
quote,
and therefore you believe it?
I do, because Michelle Malkin is a friend, and it was, you know, taken from another news source, but I didn't actually copy
right.
that.
I think it was
before.
Probably copied off Drudge, if you're talking about the one that I saw. And again, there was no source for it, there was no time for it, and there's no audio clip. I just have a hard time believing that Cindy Sheehan would say that.
Well,
on the other hand,
says,
you know, we do have George Bush saying a few things.
Can I read the quote just so
sure.
you can put in context?
Sure.
She said, quote, "America has been killing people on this continent since it was started. This country is not worth dying for."
And as I said, I don't know if she said that or not. If she did, I would criticize her for saying that. But, you know, I also would have to say that again, it would depend on the context in which it was said, because, you know, we
did fight. What context would that be correct?
Well, it is accurate to say that we engaged in genocide against Native Americans 200-300 years ago. It's not accurate to say, in my opinion, that, you know, we have this massive collective guilt that is, I mean, to the extent that we can clean that up, we need to clean that up. But, you know, that's just a whole other discussion, you know. But to say that this country is not worth dying for, you know, I can easily get that she would say that George Bush is not worth dying for, this administration is not worth dying for, and perhaps that's what she meant to say, and she misspoke. I mean, let's cut the lady some slack. Her son is dead.
Well, sure, and, you know, for every Cindy Sheehan, there's, you know, other parents. In fact, one that wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal today, that says she does not speak for me. So why can't we hear from those parents just as much as we hear from Cindy Sheehan?
But we are. I mean, I've Anderson Cooper last night did a whole show with, you know, featuring both sides. It's not uncommon.
And what were their names?
You know, frankly, I don't remember, because they're not so motivated. I mean, they have, you know, folks like you. They've got the media out there. They've got the White House. They've got the Congress. They've got the Supreme Court. I mean, they've got the war machine going. They, you know.
Well, we have this big machine going. It's not working. You know, if we're going to war for oil, that's definitely not working. You know, as maybe
I really don't
your
think
previous
that,
caller
yeah,
might have pointed out.
I really don't think that this was a war for oil.
Okay.
I really think that there was something else to this. First of all, here's Cindy Sheehan's response to Michelle Malkin, your friend, when Michelle and Bill O'Reilly were talking and said that she was a traitor. Here's Cindy's response to that.
I didn't even know Casey knew Michelle Malkin, you know, and I'm Casey's mother. I know him better than anybody else in the world, and I know Casey is up there, and Casey's saying, "You go, Mom," and he is just like saying, I can hear him going, George Bush did not know what he was going to unleash when he did this to me, you know, and I can't bring Casey back, and I wonder how often Michelle Malkin has sobbed on my son's grave. You know, did she come to his funeral? Did she sit up with him when he was sick, when he was a baby? You know, that to me, that is the most despicable thing. I can speak for my son, and I feel like it was a miracle that I got.
Well, I'll cut it off at that point.
Well, I mean, it didn't sound like Michelle Malkin was calling the son a traitor, but calling Cindy Sheehan a traitor. And I don't necessarily would call her a traitor, but, I mean, to say that she necessarily knows whether or not her son thought he was fighting for the right reasons. I mean, she really has not made any mention of what his beliefs were.
But who can speak for a
no
child
one? So I don't think she should either. Well, she can't. She can speak to her loss, but I don't think she can speak to his reasons. I mean, she's said no one should be forced to go to war unless they agree with the cause and their family agrees with the cause. Well, I mean, that's a little silly to say the whole family has to agree with the cause, but. You know,
I don't disagree with you on that. But again, I think that we're picking nits here. We have a woman who is not sophisticated in the media. She's a grieving mother. She's going to put her foot in her mouth. Why beat her up?
Well, I'm not beating her up. I'm just responding.
Sure,
to
you
what
are.
She
you're,
says.
You're. I mean, we got a press release from you guys. You're available to go on media all over the United States. You're doing as many talk shows as you can to put out the talking points against her. Why?
Well, because I think that she should be held accountable for things that she said, just as I am, and, you know, so many others. You know, Ann Coulter might slip up about coverage of Dale Earnhardt's death, and people talk about that, you know, little
bit
for the next 20 years.
And Ann Coulter laughs all the way to the bank. I mean, she's out there trying to get as much publicity as she can. She says the most outrageous things she can so that she'll get headlines, so that, you know, she can sell some more books and all that kind of thing. I mean, it's a business for Ann Coulter. This is not a business for Cindy Sheehan. Her son has died.
I think it will turn into a business. I mean, it's unfortunate that it had to be that situation.
If you're that cynical, Lisa, I'm really sad for you.
Well, I would say that for anyone. I mean,
you think anyone whose child dies and who speaks up on a principled way should turn it into a business?
Well, there's a difference between, you know, speaking up and, you know, camping outside the president's private home and, you know, doing so many media appearances. I mean, there's pictures going around of, you know, her being primped before her media thing and the PR people out there telling everyone, okay, guys, let's get it going.
Wouldn't you do the same?
No,
if you
I
had a cause that you believed in, you wouldn't want to try and get it out as widely as you can, then why are you doing this right now? You're doing the same thing.
If I had a cause, but a way to grieve for someone in my family that's died, no, I wouldn't do that. And I think because...
How do you know?
Because I know what sort of person I am. And
but,
I also,
but you don't know what it's like to have a child die, do you?
No, but I know how I deal with grief. And, I mean, I think, you know, why aren't there so many other people that are, you know, in her same situation, people that even disagree with
her?
Well,
actually, this morning on my morning program here on KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, we had a phone call from two mothers from Portland, mothers of children who both died in Iraq, mm-hmm. who got on a plane yesterday and flew down to Crawford to stand with Cindy. I mean, there's a lot of mothers who are showing up down there in Crawford.
Well, I don't know.
This is two from just one city.
What the total number is, but I also know that there's also parents that are going to Crawford to remove their cross, you know, with their children's name on it because they don't want, you know, their children to be affiliated with some of the efforts there. And
so,
I think,
so George Bush's war is dividing America even more.
No, I don't think so. I think that people that I don't think that Cindy Sheehan's son dying changed her view on the war in Iraq.
I don't think it did either. So what?
Well, I think it's important to know that. That's kind of the basis for, you know, her reasoning. I mean, she said in response to, you know, the other family members, mostly on her on Casey's father's side, releasing a statement saying that we would rather grieve in private and we think that, you know, Cindy's motivation has become a political movement.
Mm-hmm.
She said in response to that, well, they've always been Republicans and I'm a Democrat.
Right.
So, I mean, to me, it's like, well, why not?
Welcome to a family in America.
I'm the mother. I mean, why is the first thing, well, they've always been Republicans.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
why
because,
not?
Because,
I gave birth to my
made
son.
It partisan. Yeah, she did. She
yeah,
did.
But that's not, that wasn't the statement that she released. I mean, she released saying, well, they didn't really know him as well, and they're all, yeah. you know, Republicans anyway.
But I mean, you know, here you've got Cindy Sheehan. She's down there. She shows up with her sister all alone with a, you know, with a chair and nothing behind her. And then here comes Lisa DePasquale, who's being paid to go on my program and trash her. I just don't think it's right.
I'd actually be getting the same amount if I wasn't on your program, but...
But, I mean, this is part of your job, right?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I hope actually that your listeners are nicer to me than they were last time.
Well, that's why I haven't let any through. In fact, we've got to wrap it up. But, Lisa, I appreciate your coming on.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I really do. I hope that you'll reconsider what you're doing. I hope you'll think very carefully about this and perhaps speak with some of these mothers of children who have died over there before you go any farther on this. But thank you for being with us. The Claire Booth Luce Policy Institute is Lisa's organization, cblpi.org. Lisa DePasquale. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Say what you want, mean what you say. Remember the deepest seeds still find the light of day.
And welcome back, my friends.
Do as you please.
I don't know what to think of it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's 25 minutes past the hour, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, and Ellen Ratner is with us, our bureau chief in Washington, D.C., with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
Yes, hi, how are you doing? Listen,
I am great. What's up?
I got news for you. We have an interesting story today.
Okay.
We tried to, when we went up to get the records from Roberts last week.
This is Judge John Roberts.
Right. It was actually on Monday, I believe, or Friday, I can't remember. But we went up and we got a CD of all the records.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was simple and easy, and we got the hard copies, and we got the CD, and all that kind of stuff. So that was, you know, that's what we expected when we went up today. Oh, no, not at all.
Hmm.
The records are now in boxes. They have not made any copies of them. And what essentially is now happening with this is that they're doing a lottery. So there's 100 news organizations that want in. They're allowing 70 news organizations. What you get to do is they have a list of all the boxes. You can pick one box. You can go through that one box. You're not allowed to make copies of anything. You can report on what's in your box, and you only have till 6 or 7 p.m. to do it.
And these are the guys who complained that Howard Dean wasn't releasing all his gubernatorial papers that had to do with the gay marriage debate, where he was saying he didn't want to reveal the names of people. Mostly it was letters from citizens, and he didn't want to reveal private correspondence with citizens on such a personal topic, and they savaged him for it.
Exactly. But these are records that he wrote for the White House. Now, why was there one set of records that we're getting on CD that have been scanned, and this set of records, we had to sit in line for 2 hours today, pick our one box, not really understanding the total contents of it, and that's all we get.
And so NBC gets one box, CBS gets one box, ABC gets one
box. Right, now, what, that's exactly
And Judicial Watch gets one box, so some right-wing group gets a box?
Well, Judicial Watch is not an accredited press organization. It has to be accredited to the Hill.
Fox News gets one box?
That's right. And that's how it's working.
The Washington Times gets one box. That's pretty amazing.
I have been here for, 14 years covering Washington, and honestly, I have never heard of such a thing.
So this is a bit of a breach of protocol, eh?
Well, that's right. But, and to not put these on CDs or to not say to the press, well, okay, you can make copies of things that you're interested in. So they're essentially cutting off all ability of the press to really do a fair analysis of what's in there. And it'll be like Six Blind Men and the Elephant, where everybody gets a piece.
I wonder why they would do that, Ellen.
I wonder why.
This what's happening is that it is becoming more and more obvious to people, and Pat Leahy put voice to it day before yesterday, that this guy is a right-wing extremist of the most extreme stripe in virtually any topic you want to pick, from corporate governance to gay rights to the rights of African Americans and things like public policy with regard to affirmative action, with regard to voting rights. I mean, you just continue right on down the list. This guy is off the edge.
And speaking of leaks, my friend, they're going to have, it looks like Pete Hoekstra is going to have some hearings on classified leaks. He wants new penalties on them, but the Democrats are very worried that he's going to gloss over what's happening with the Flynn case. So this is going to be an interesting fight on the Hill.
Yeah, it won't be retroactive, I guarantee you. If a Republican is proposing legislation to harm leakers, it's not going to touch Karl Rove.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, it really is. Ellen, thanks so much for the report today.
You're welcome.
It's absolutely fascinating what's going on. Here, pick a box, any box, but you can only have one box. Good luck. That's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Ellen. We'll see you later. It is 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. This is the place where smart people get their news, the true people's radio, the free speech, the real free speech zone. No barbed wire fences, no passes from the RNC required. We won't haul you away if you've got a No Blood for Oil bumper sticker.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy as you
let it. Welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You are in the center of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Bill O'Reilly. Apparently this was yesterday. This is from Media Matters. It said, tonight Bill O'Reilly was determined to prove that his portrayal of Cindy Sheehan as a far-left radical intent on embarrassing President Bush was accurate. He devoted 3 segments to Cindy Sheehan's destruction and became increasingly agitated when his guests failed to give him the answers he wanted. While talking to Joe Trippi, O'Reilly said that Sheehan had lied, then backed down when Trippi condemned that as hateful rhetoric. The more O'Reilly attacked Cindy Sheehan, the worse he looked himself. During the Talking Points segment, O'Reilly was quite pleased that the New York Times had printed a retraction to an article that claimed that he had called Sheehan treasonous when he actually hadn't used that word. Then Bill added that the New York Times must have gotten the erroneous information from a far-left website that has been going after him. Maybe they'd be the news hounds. They say, you know, we watch Fox, so you don't have to. Next, Joe Trippi appeared and was introduced as the organizer of the infamous conference call with several blogs, including the news hounds. O'Reilly kept asking Trippi in disbelief if he believed that Sheehan was a political player and member of the far left. I'd like to know, who is the far left in America? I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, I mean, if you define the classic political spectrum of, on the far left, you have essentially the Marxists and the communists, those who believe that the means of production and distribution should be entirely owned by the government. The government should own all the factories. The government should own all the stores. The government should be basically the only employer. The government should own all land. Everybody becomes a renter from the government. And this is how it worked in the Soviet Union. I was there during that time. I visited there. I've seen it in both Russia and East Germany. And also, from each according to his ability, to each according to his means. In other words, everybody works at whatever job they're assigned, or they can work their way into, as hard as they can, and they get a salary that reflects what their needs are, rather than what their ability may be or what their effort is. I mean, this is Karl Marx, right? And so that's historically been the far left. And the name that has been assigned to it is communism. The name that Marx and Engels came up with in Das Kapital. And so there's your far left. And then on the far right, you have historically had the fascists. Benito Mussolini, the former head of Spain. There were several other fascist countries, or there have been over the years. I think, frankly, you could argue, well, Kim Jong-il, he's communist. He's not fascist. In any case, see, there's a certain amount of overlap in strange ways because both of them devolve into dictatorships eventually. But what Mussolini did and what Franco did in Spain, certainly, what Mussolini did was he said, okay, we've got to bring the corporations into the government to build a strong entity. After all, the government is a fragile thing, and that's not a good thing to have governments constantly changing. And Italy is notorious for governments being knocked over, over and over and over again. And so Mussolini said, well, you know, the way to create a strong government is to take the strongest elements of society and bring them into the government. Who are the strongest elements of society? Well, in the 1920s, when Mussolini was president or prime minister of Italy, the strongest elements were the corporations. So he dissolved Parliament and replaced it with the Cameo de Fascisio Corporaciones, or however that's correctly said in Italian, the Chamber of the Fascist Corporations. And if you lived in Italy at that time, well, let's say it was done here in the United States. I live in Oregon. Nike's in Oregon. Their headquarters are just, you know, 20 miles from me. So if I lived in Oregon and we became a truly fascist state, in the Mussolini sense, then instead of being represented in the Senate by Ron Wyden and Gordon Smith, I would be represented by Phil Knight or his representative. The biggest corporation, well, there'd probably be two of them. Maybe they'd throw in Hewlett-Packard or something. I don't know. But, you know, the two largest corporations in the state would send their representatives to Washington, D.C., and they'd represent our state. That's what Mussolini did in Italy. That's fascism, the merger of business and state interests. Now, unfortunately, what we have in the United States at this moment is a whole lot of fascist legislators. We've got a lot of legislators who are primarily working for corporate interests rather than for the interests of we the people. And it certainly that stops. It starts at the top very much. And then George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, you know, I've had this longstanding, it's been almost 2 years now, I think, since Tom Tancredo was on this program, the Republican from Colorado. And I said, you know, Congressman Tancredo, can you please name one piece of legislation that originated with your party, with the Republican Party, that was passed through the House and Senate and signed into law by the president that didn't primarily benefit corporations before it benefited individual human beings, citizens? and he was unable to. We still have this contest going. I'll give a free book to anybody who can come up with one. I think we found like one rather benign piece of legislation someplace. I forget what it was now. But, I mean, it's, as you know, it's the rarity. That would be the exception that proves the rule, in fact. So on the left, you've got communism. On the right, you've got fascism. Now, this country certainly has not moved to the far left. And frankly, I don't know anybody who is advocating the extreme leftist policies of Marxism. I don't advocate them. I don't know anybody who does. I know that there are people out there who do. The Communist Party of the U.S. is still alive. It has maybe 40 members. I don't know. You know, maybe a few hundred, probably a few thousand. But it's been completely marginalized, in large part because of the purges of the McCarthyism era and the persecution by the FBI and whatnot, and in some part because of the hysteria around the Soviet Union, the anti-communist fear, and in some perhaps larger part because it didn't work. You know, as a political system, it didn't work. So here we have this political situation where you've got really basically two groups left. You've got the folks like me and you know, Bernie Sanders and Pat Leahy and I'm not sure what politicians would want to lump themselves in with me. Maybe I shouldn't name any, but you know what I'm talking about. You know, progressive Democrats and even a couple of progressive Republicans out there who are saying, no, the purpose of government should be to administer the commons and serve the people to the extent that the people want to be served. If the people want to have national health care, then they should have national health care because their elected representatives say, hey, this is something that we want. For example. And to serve the interests of we the people. And if, you know, corporations want their interests served, that's what the free marketplace is for. They can compete against other corporations. They shouldn't be participating in governance. On the one hand, you've got, you know, folks like me saying that. And then on the other hand, you've got folks saying, hey, corporations should run everything. Like the fellow from the Ayn Rand Institute who started our program an hour and a half ago, saying that capitalism is a political system. Well, if capitalism is a political system, then how do you figure out who's going to govern? Because politics is about governance. How do you figure out who's in charge? If capitalism is your political system, then the way you figure out who's in charge is by which corporation has the most power. That's called fascism. We've been there. We've seen that movie. Been there, done that, right? We don't want to go there again. Well, there are actually some among us who do want to. George Bush, Dick Cheney, Tom DeLay, Denny Hastert, Bill Frist. Then the list goes on and on. I would toss Joe Lieberman into that pot. I would say that the DLC Democrats are selling us out down, you know, in that direction. There's, you know, at least a couple of dozen members of the House and Senate who are Democrats who I would put in that category. So anyhow, you got Bill O'Reilly here. Back to my original point. Bill O'Reilly saying that Cindy Sheehan is a tool of the radical left. I'm sorry, the radical left is dead. There is no radical left for all practical purposes in the United States. There is the radical right, and they have seized control of the United States government. And there is the rest of us. There's the middle. The radical middle. And we're getting radicalized, you know, it's like, hey, you know, we would like our government back, thank you very much. Yeah, but I rant on. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Barbara in Murfreesboro, Illinois is on the line. Hey, Barbara, welcome to the program.
Hi. Hi, Tom. I just wanted to agree with you that we do want our country back, and I would just like to respond to the woman that you had on from the Claire Booth Luce Institute.
Right. Yeah, Claire Booth Luce Policy Institute, which is I suspect Claire Booth Luce is rolling in her grave, but who knows? She was one of the founders. Her family founded the Washington Post. But
I see.
Yeah. Anyhow.
Well, let me just bring up two or three points.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of which side you're on, Republican or Democrat, they did bring out early on when Cindy Sheehan started her protest that. And they interviewed her. She did talk to her son. She discussed talking to her son about the war, trying to get him not to go. She didn't agree with it. She said he felt that it was his duty, and that's the reason he gave.
Yeah, he was not willing to say, hey, you know, I joined the military, but I'm not going to go off to your war, whether I agree with it or not. His duty as a member of the military was to do what he was told.
Right. And I feel that some people are missing the point or trying to change the subject. This administration, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or an independent, this administration lied about the facts.
Yeah.
And there are thousands and thousands of people dying, whether they're Americans or Iraqis, because of this. And to give an and I feel that the administration is not placing enough importance on this. To give you an example, when Rumsfeld goes to visit Iraq to look things over, he rides around in a Rhino Rover.
Right, which is owned by Halliburton,
which is heavily armed.
Yeah.
Our troops are not given the proper equipment. That they're riding around in Humvees that are not armed, that are not plated right.
Yeah, no. In fact, Humvees are not even designed as combat vehicles. You know, combat vehicles are tanks and half tracks and things like that. Humvees, at the maximum use in the military for Humvees generally is for military police and for medics. And, you know,
right.
that's pretty much it. Because, you know, there's no way to really armor a Humvee because you can't under-armor it. You can't put the armor underneath it.
Well,
over a bomb, it still goes up.
Right. And another fact that should be brought out is that originally the military was going to use these vehicles called Fleas, which are more heavily armed. And for some reason, they dropped that contract. And these are some of the things that should be looked into.
Yeah, the absolute and utter incompetence of the Bush administration and the Defense Department under Donald Rumsfeld is breathtaking. Barbara, thank you for calling and pointing those things out.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Great hearing from you. Thank you very much. 1-866-889-8894. Josh in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Josh, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Love you, Tom. Went to a vigil protest for Cindy Sheehan and Casey Sheehan last night in Atlanta.
Great.
Over 800. It was one of many, of course, put on and propagated by MoveOn.org across the country. Bad points. Local Fox affiliate shows up, and they showed up at 9. It started at 7:30. Channel 2, Channel 11, you know, there was like three other channels that got there on time. Fox shows up at 9.
Right. Hoping that there'll be three people left with one candle between them, right?
Of course, it's a classic. This Bush administration has had them, you know, given them so much practice in doing this.
Yeah.
They show up an hour and a half later, but there were still 800 people there. That was actually the peak of numbers, but they were just getting out their equipment. Then at 10, they go on live, and there's like 50 people left.
Right.
And it's just classic. It's what they do. Another bad point, there was only one person that got out of line and was anti-protesting. Actually, only one person I ever even heard who was promoting the war.
Mm-hmm.
And he yelled from a car, "I'm for effing Bush."
Mm.
And somebody else said, "Well, I don't want to eff him." And then he said, "Well, I'm for the effing war."
Yeah.
And then somebody said, "Well, go enlist. I heard they got an opening just this morning."
There you go.
I heard the Army's numbers are down. Go ahead and enlist. If you're going to sit there and be an armchair patriot and promote the war, go enlist.
Yeah, the question I should have asked Michelle is why doesn't she enlist if she cares so much about this?
There you go. Come on, Michelle.
But it's also kind of a cheap shot. I mean, the fact of the matter is we're all entitled to our political opinions, and we don't have to enlist. It's the flip side of what the right was saying during the Vietnam War, you know, love it or leave it. I'm sorry, there are more options than that. There is love it and oppose it as well.
True, but, there is such a thing as an armchair patriot. It's a new beast in this country. I can't believe it. It's a zeitgeist. It's weird. These people that just sit by with their little magnet ribbon on the tail of their car, and they say, "Well, I'm for them, you know. It's what we got to do."
Josh, we have to have a lot of compassion for those people because the reality is that they don't know the facts. I have to believe, and I do believe, I, in fact, I know it, that when folks like that are informed of the actual facts, they change their mind generally.
Yeah.
It's Americans are not evil people.
We can't hate them. We just have to hate the stupidity that comes out of their mouths.
Well,
we need to do what you do.
We need to try and wake them up.
Yeah, wake them up like you do. And we need to actually. You remind me of like a great college professor or something. I mean, you're not a radio host. You're actually a teacher. I mean, it's amazing.
Well,
and everybody.
Don't tell anybody in the radio industry that, Josh, because then I'll never get another job. but I appreciate your kind words. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I appreciate your listening. It's the Tom Hartman, your radio professor. I don't know. I started out as a DJ 30 years ago. It's took 20 years off, but. And then got back into this, but I did it for, well, I did music for 3 years, and I did news for 7 years, and then took 20 years off, and then got back into it 2 years ago. Anyhow, welcome. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Bring them on.
To all the troops I sent to war, who won't be coming home no more, I'm glad you came along. I dedicate this song to all the troops I sent.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, George W. Wouldn't it be nice if he had such a conscience that he actually started wanting to speak up about the lies that he had told that have led to so many deaths? Josh Lucas, actor Josh Lucas, last night in Los Angeles holding up a sign at one of the candlelight vigils, "Before one more mother's child is lost, W is not the answer." Actor Richard Dreyfuss at the same candlelight vigil holding up a sign, "Bring our children home." Actor Ed Begley Jr. at the sign holding a candle as he walks down the street. So, you know, a few people have gotten out on this thing. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Daryl in Minneapolis on the line. Hey, Daryl, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I'm a first-time caller. This is my first time calling any radio show.
Well, great. Thank you. Yeah. Welcome to our program.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, you mentioned that the Communist Party has been marginalized.
By and large, yeah.
Yeah, and I was wondering what's happened to the former parties of the far right, like the American Nazis?
Well, the American Nazis are still around. They've been marginalized as well, but they're still there. You know, the Ku Klux Klan.
I was wondering if they were lying low, really.
Well, what's happened, unfortunately, is what's happened, unfortunately, is that a lot of their doctrines have been adopted by the Republican Party. And I don't mean that in some glib, you know, slap the Republican Party way, but, you know, the doctrines of bring corporations in, fight affirmative action, the policies that have traditionally been associated with the KKK and the Nazi Party, many of them, certainly not all of them, probably not even most of them, some of them, let's say, have been adopted by the Republicans, tragically.
Yeah, right.
Daryl, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay,
great
thank
Great to
you.
Hear from you.
Bye.
I appreciate it. And thanks for hanging on hold there for a while. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the USA. And yes, I do believe we can do it. One of the folks in our chat room saying, come on, I think that the rabble are going to break this country. No, I think the rabble are going to be... I agree with Thomas Jefferson. The rabble are the salvation of this country. He said, it is not to the rich to whom I look for the salvation of my country. It is to the people. I agree.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. You probably missed this from the San Francisco Chronicle today, writes patriotic liberal on the Daily Kos. This from the San Francisco Chronicle. As Sheehan supporters gathered at vigils Wednesday, Deborah Johns of Roseville, California, was in Sacramento filming an anti-Sheehan commercial. Yes, my friends, the swift voting has officially begun. Republican strategist Sal Russo produced the ad, and a spokesman for his consulting firm expects it to begin airing on CNN and Fox News within a week. Apparently, they've decided she's not going away, and this phenomena isn't going to go away, so they're going to swift vote her. They're going to lie about her. They're going to savage her. Mr. Johns will lead a caravan dubbed You Don't Speak For Me, Cindy. This is the Republican strategist. Excuse me, Deborah Johns. Yeah, the Republican strategist is going to lead this caravan dubbed You Don't Speak For Me, Cindy, that departs San Francisco on Monday for Crawford. The effort is being organized by a local talk show host in San Francisco. This is so pathetic. You know, this is just so pathetic. It's like, you know, how can I just see this local talk show host saying, you know, well, how can we get on this Cindy Sheehan thing? How can we get some local publicity for this? Right. Well, let's organize a caravan across America. We'll get some money from the Republicans. We'll get a lot of publicity. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm in the business. I know how this works. That's sick. That is really sick. How low can you get? What are you going to say? That Cindy isn't really Casey's mother? I mean, you said John Kerry really wasn't a war hero. What are you going to say? She didn't really have a son. It just blows my mind. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Ed in San Juan Capistrano. Just a second, we're going to be talking with Anthony Wade. But before that, first, hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I just wanted to talk about this Michael Moore.
Yeah.
You know, I believe we honestly create our own little monsters or problems. And Michael Moore was created when Roger closed down the plant in
Roger Smith, the president
Roger
of General
Smith.
Motors, yes.
And if it wasn't for that, Michael Moore and his family would still be earning their $50,000 or $60,000 a year very quietly working. But because we shipped his job to another country...
To Mexico specifically. GM opened plants in Mexico the same year that they closed plants in Flint, Michigan.
So the next time a right-winger tells you how bad Michael Moore is, they made him.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, Ed, good point.
Just wanted to say that.
Sure, and if you want to know more about it, go rent Roger and Me by Michael Moore. He's the first movie he ever made, and it is absolutely brilliant. You also have to rent The Big One by Michael Moore if you want to know about the more modern version of this. Anthony Wade is with us. Anthony wrote a piece. He's a contributing writer to opednews.com, and he wrote a piece for this that was titled An Open Letter to Christians. And it really caught my interest because I think that, you know, there needs to be this voice out there speaking this. Op-Ed News is a progressive news site, but the introduction to Anthony's letter starts out, I'm a born-again, fiscal and social conservative who serves only one master, Jesus Christ. The fact that George Bush says he is a Christian is no longer persuading me. Anthony, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
George Bush has been peddling himself as you know, the Christianity's answer to politics or the other way around for some time now. And the Republicans have been working very aggressively to try and drag Christian politics in particular into partisan politics, particularly giving over $1 billion to churches last year through the so-called faith-based initiatives program that when he couldn't get it through Congress, Bush simply created by executive fiat. How do you as a Christian respond to Bush's use of Christianity?
Well, I think that you phrase it correctly. He uses it, and Christianity in general should not be something that is used. I don't doubt his salvation. I don't doubt his Christianity. I just think that we're instructed to look at a person's walk. Walk meaning, you know, how exactly they behave as a Christian after they become saved.
By their works they shall be known.
Yes. And faith without works is dead.
Yeah.
And I think that when you look at his policies, they're decidedly non-Christian, and I think he uses it to solidify that portion of his base.
How can you, Anthony? I understand your desire to not judge and to, you know, give him the benefit of the doubt and all that sort of thing.
If you read some of my previous work, I don't think you'd be saying that. But
okay. I'm asking, how can you say that you don't doubt his salvation, you know, in the context of Christianity, and yet he, you know, believe that he is intentionally responsible for something that has led to the death of over 100,000 people?
What I mean by that is that the story, according to George Bush, is that he was saved in the early 1990s due to a weekend visit from the Reverend Billy Graham. Even though Billy Graham himself does not quite recall having that effect on the younger Bush, I don't doubt that that event occurred. That's what I'm saying. That's what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, the other story that you hear from the unauthorized biographies is that his wife, after being beat up one time too many in a drunken rage, told him that if he didn't quit drinking, she and the daughters were moving out.
There's a lot of things that can push somebody, you know, to the point where they really reexamine their life and possibly accept Christ. I'm just saying it's not my position as a Christian to doubt another Christian's salvation.
Yeah, but from the point of salvation, the point of conversion or whatever you want to call that, becoming born again in the parlance of your and George Bush's frame of Christianity.
Yes.
From that point forward, it's possible to fall out of being born again, is it not?
It depends on who you ask. There are some who believe that salvation cannot be lost. There are some who believe that salvation can be lost, but it's a high threshold. The only issue is whether or not he believed in, at the time that he became saved, he was being genuine in his heart. And if that's the case, then he's saved.
But what if then he violates the teachings of Jesus overtly and explicitly?
Right, and
is he still going to heaven?
There's plenty of competing scriptures. I actually belong to an Assemblies of God church, and they actually believe that you can lose your salvation.
Yeah, I've attended Assemblies of God churches. It's been 30 years, but for the better part of a year, actually.
Right.
So I'm familiar with your church. You asked the questions in your article. You said your spirit grieves over this war. How much is enough for you? How many kids have to die?
Yes.
These are really tough questions. You've been criticized by Christians for daring to speak against the president. How, when you speak out in the Christian community about these kinds of things, what kind of reaction do you get?
What prompted this was I had done an article the week before about using some verses from Proverbs about when Cindy Sheehan first started, and I got a response from a pastor of an AOG church in the Midwest, and we exchanged emails for about three emails, and he was saying I was being seduced by forces on the far left and some of the other stuff that's in here, and actually that is what prompted me to do this, the open letter to Christians.
Right.
So what kind of criticism? I think, like I say in here, that Christians are so happy that they have somebody who's in public office who's willing to say the name of Jesus Christ and not in reaction to stubbing their toe, that they're willing to kind of look the other way on some things that to me appear to be quite anti-Christian.
But you have the situation where the Methodist Church, which George Bush is a member of and Dick Cheney is a member of, has officially come out against the war in Iraq. The bishops of the Methodist Church, before Bush invaded Iraq, asked for a private meeting with him to discuss the pending invasion. He refused.
Mm-hmm.
The Pope of the Catholic Church, Pope John Paul II, officially came out against the Iraq war.
Mm-hmm.
The current Pope, Pope Benedict XVI, has said that this is not a just war. I mean, you have his own Christian church, you have the world's largest Christian church, both of them saying, please don't, and this is not right.
Right. But when push came to shove during the election season, who did they organize their members to go vote for?
Well, that's a good question. I mean,
I know the answer. The answer is George Bush.
Right, but it wasn't about the war. You had Cardinal Ratzinger.
They're willing to look the other way because of the social wedge issues that Bush wields so well.
I was just going to say, you had Ratzinger sending letters to Catholic bishops in the United States. As he was the head of the old Inquisition, Committee of Faith or whatever it's called in the Catholic Church, sending letters to the bishops in the United States saying that giving communion to John Kerry would be wrong, and kind of leading this revolt against John Kerry, which, you know, just around the issue of abortion, which just seemed to me.
And Kerry did a very poor job of formulating his stand on abortion, but quite frankly, it was better than this vague culture of life reference that George Bush was pushing around so much that really meant nothing.
Yeah. With regard to, so it's clear to me where, you know, I think, you haven't said it explicitly, but that you believe that this war is not something, this, you know, the question, who would Jesus bomb? This is
not, no, this war is not just.
Yeah, it's not a just war. Okay.
No, I think that you know, and I say it here, especially from a Christian perspective, we're not supposed to believe in man-made security. We're supposed to believe that our security and safety comes from God. So this, first of all, Iraq had nothing to do with terrorism, and nothing to do with 9/11, nothing to do with Al Qaeda. Clearly, from the Downing Street memos, I think it's pretty clear that George Bush actually committed felonies to lie to Congress to get us to go to war. I think there's a lot of underlying, you know, reasons for people, not just Christians, to say, wait a minute, you know, what are we doing there? Sure, it's a central war on terror now, but that's because he made it that way.
So, and then the next step, his stewardship of the environment, his stewardship of the commons in the United States. What do you believe should be the Christian position on that?
Well, I mean, God entrusts us with the earth, and we're supposed to be good stewards of it. He actually has been there to say he is a good steward of it. Clearly, he is sided with corporations, not just the environment, but I mean, he's a corporate president. That's what bothers me from a Christian perspective, is Christians think he's a Christian president. He's not. He's a corporate president. The judges that were being filibustered were not strict pro-life judges. They were strict business judges.
Yeah, especially John Roberts.
I wasn't even talking about him. I was talking about the original filibuster problem with the appellate judges.
Right.
I mean, one of those women had 177-0 record siding with corporations against human beings.
Right, Janice Rogers Brown.
Yeah, that didn't strike me as being particularly Christian.
Yeah.
Somebody had to have been right, you know. It's the law of averages.
So what, we have about a minute left. We're talking with Anthony Wade. He wrote a piece for opednews.com, and you can find it on opednews.com in the archives there. Anthony, what's your message? What's your call to action to Christians? What would you suggest that Christians do?
I think the Christians need to really examine their own walk. And I think that people who get hung up on life issues, which are certainly important, but I think I said in the piece, you cannot state that abortion is a blight upon humanity at the same time that you're supporting killing people in another country. And I think that people need to take a look at their own hypocrisy, and whether or not, what are the teachings of Jesus Christ? I get the Old Testament a lot from people on this, but, you know, unless you're Jewish, don't be quoting the Old Testament to me, because you're supposed to be under the New Covenant. And the teachings of Christ from the Sermon on the Mount, the teachings from Christ about turning the other cheek, you know, I don't hear a lot of that from the rabid war crowd who, you know, has a lot of hate. And every single person that dies in that country, whether they're American or not, was supposed to be saved for the kingdom of Jesus Christ. And if you're a Christian, that's what you're supposed to be concentrating on.
Okay. Well said. Anthony Wade, thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you, Bob.
For, you know, laying out for us in a quite articulate way the Christian position on George, or a Christian position on George W. Bush. Much appreciated. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Why me, George? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the plagues that you've sown? Tell me, George, what did I ever do for a whiz kid like you to bring chaos to my home? Lord, help me, Jesus. We didn't vote for him, but we can't ignore him, I fear. He's using your name to advance his own game. Now we're in doo-doo, way up to here.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes. That's Jim Turr from BlueCanyonSatire.com, BlueCanyonProductions.com. Yes, why me, George? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the plagues that you've sown? Unlike the Sandy Berger documents, duplicates of the missing John Roberts file, speaking of peddling Christianity for political purposes, may not exist. when news broke last year that former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, this is from the Daily Kos, Advisor Sandy Berger was under investigation for removing several National Archives documents. Conservatives went nuts. I mean, they went absolutely nuts. They were like, oh, look at that Sandy Berger. He's stuffing them in his pants. Turned out his pants was his pants pocket. But, you know, it conjured up this image of this guy just wadding paper down in his pants and waddling out of the National Archives. Turns out it was actually photocopies that he made. He had to testify before the 9/11 Commission, and he wanted to review what he had written and what he had said so that he could give accurate testimony. He broke the rules of the National Archives of taking photocopies out without specific permissions. But, you know, he didn't destroy anything. He wasn't trying to cover anything up. He wasn't trying to hide anything the way the cons tried to paint it. Now, where are those same cons now? When the government sends a few lawyers in to look over Roberts' files, the White House sends a few of their lawyers in, and then somehow the files are missing. It's not that the lawyers walked out with copies of them. It's that the files are missing. When news broke last year that, as I mentioned, the former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger was under investigation, conservatives went nuts. But Fox News host Brit Hume claimed that Berger was afraid the documents showed that President Clinton had been too soft on terrorists. Yeah, right. That theory that he was trying to hide something or cover Bill Clinton's tracks, said Brit Hume, made more sense than anything else. Likewise, William Kristol asserted that Berger was trying to steal the original copies of the document. He said, and I quote, "It's not correct to say that there are copies of what Sandy Berger took away elsewhere," end quote. And so went the attacks on prominent conservatives. Denny Hastert saying Berger's trying to hide information from the 9/11 Commission. Tom DeLay saying it's a third-rate burglary. Right, reference to Watergate. Just one problem. The central point was all false. He didn't take any originals. Now we have the John Roberts documents, as the Washington Post stated today, quote, "No duplicates of the folder's contents were made before the lawyer's review." In other words, unlike the Berger case, notes this post at the Daily Kos, unlike the Berger case, the missing file may very well contain the only original copies of some documents. And what's more important, unlike the Berger case, anyone interested in concealing the information in those documents could do so by stealing them. So where now are the right-wing super sleuths? Asks the Daily Kos. Where now are the detectives on the Reich who are so certain that somebody's out to cover something up? Any discussion, do you think, on Fox News about cover-ups with regard to John Roberts? Somehow I rather doubt it. I suspect they'll be talking about Cindy Sheehan instead, and how she's really not Casey's mother, or some other Swiftbodian style of the politics of personal destruction, slander. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
In the good old USA, I'd just like to say, tomorrow's dreams are always coming true.
And welcome back, my friends.
And the whole blessed world, all the little boys and girls, are counting on the old red, white, and blue.
There you go. We got to take back the old red, white, and blue. 27 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. I just wanted to mention to those of you who have been listening to the program for a long time, you know that Small Dog Electronics has been sponsoring this program for over a year. They still are. And a great organization if you need anything electronic, anything computer-wise. Their phone number, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS. And we have a new sponsor that I just wanted to mention very briefly. And this is not an added announcement for which they paid. This is just, I just wanted to say this. This product, MotorSilk, is really cool stuff. It bonds boron, a metal, to the surface of the inside of your car engine. Now, that doesn't sound very sexy or jazzy, but I'll tell you what it does is it dramatically increases gas mileage, reduces wear, and thus helps the environment. And reduces the amount of, you know, carbon fuels that we're using. It reduces the amount of gasoline we're burning, reduces the amount of oil that you're using up, all those things. And I think that that's a good thing. So I just want to give them a plug. Not, you know, yes, they're a sponsor. But the main reason I wanted to give them a plug is because I think it's a great product. I have it in my car. I I've turned a couple of friends onto it. I think it's great stuff. Their phone number, 866-LESS-FUEL, if you're curious. Or Evergreen America is their website. Just as an FYI. Every now and then, once a month or so, I feel that I should, you know, make some comment about the folks that, you know, sometimes you have sponsors who you just run their ads. Other times you have sponsors that you think, this is really cool stuff. And Small Dog Electronics and Motor Silk are like really good companies, really good people with really great products. So I'm really pleased that they're sponsoring our program. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. Outside the United States, 503-248-0620. TomHartmann.com, of course, our website if you want to drop into the live chat room. And I do want to get into a brief discussion of the bird flu. I think this is an important topic. But first, we got Ben in Illinois on the line. Hey, Ben, what's up?
Here, Tom. Just a couple of things. First, a report from the Elgin, Illinois vigil last night.
Okay.
Where we had, in the heart of Dennis Hastert country, we had over 60 people.
That's great. Dennis Hastert is your representative, huh?
Yes, and if he has the temerity to run again, we really plan to paste him this time.
Boy, you have my sympathy. I used to live in the northern Atlanta suburbs, and Newt Gingrich was my congressman. We've been there, done that.
We've got not only do we have him taking bribes this time, though, but we've got him, you know, we've still got the old stuff from the House banking scandal that none of us here have forgotten.
Yeah, okay.
Just going back to your person from the Claire Booth Luce Institute,
yes.
Lisa, she reminds me a lot of David Brock before he found his conscience.
Yeah, and my hope for Lisa is that there is a conscience there, that she's not a George Bush clone, that she's not somebody who doesn't feel emotions. I suspect that there's a real person there and that she's doing what, you know, by and large, she probably agrees with the politics of that organization. And when they ask her to do this kind of thing, it's just part of her job, and she just does it. I'm hoping. I mean, you try to think the best of people.
I try to, too, as difficult as that becomes. We had two military families last night at the vigil. Fortunately, neither of which have lost their loved one yet. But as Bush calls anybody who's dead their loved one. They both are serving abroad in combat zones, one in Afghanistan and one in Iraq. And they say the conditions there are really a lot worse than are reported to us here.
Yeah, that's got to be very, very scary. Ben, thanks for the report.
You take care.
You too, and thanks for the call. It's, it is grim times. Speaking of grim times, the reason that I want to discuss this about the potential of a bird flu epidemic is not to scare the bejesus out of you, although it appropriately should, but more to say, if we don't start speaking up loudly and quickly, then it may be too late to do anything about this. And it appears that there is still time if this government will devote the resources and money to it. And what I'm talking about is the I think it's H5N1 or H1N5. H5N1 variant of the flu, the influenza. That's the variant, the genotype of the flu that killed millions of people, perhaps as many as 100 million people, in the great flu epidemic of 1918. And I remember my mother telling me stories that she heard as a child about how her father, during the flu epidemic up in Charlevoix, Michigan, went door to door with his long black coat in the winter, bringing food to families who had members who had just died or were dying or were sick with the flu. And that he and her mother survived the great flu epidemic and you know, work to serve their community throughout that. And it was a very, very, very scary time. And we have the ability to anticipate this, whereas before, you know, we didn't have that ability to anticipate what might be going on. And a startling and brilliant piece by Mike Davis, published on commondreams.org in the last couple of days, Deadly Avian Flu is on the Wing. The title of the article is Has Time Run Out? And he notes the first bar-headed geese have already arrived at their wintering grounds near the Shauvery River in the southern Indian state of Karnataka. Over the next 10 weeks, 100,000 more geese, gulls, and cormorants will leave their summer home at Lake Qinghai in western China, headed for India, Bangladesh, Myanmar, and eventually Australia. An unknown number of these beautiful migrating birds will carry H5N1, the avian flu subtype that has killed 61 people so far in Southeast Asia, and that the WHO, the World Health Organization, fears is on the edge of mutating into a virus that could kill hundreds of millions of humans. The birds, as they migrate in from their homes right now, where we know that they have this flu virus, are going into Dhaka and Kolkata and Karachi and Mumbai, and you're spreading the possibility of this flu to domestic poultry and to humans. All it takes is one mutation in one virus, and one bird can carry billions of viruses, hundreds of billions. And this is you know, a deep concern. The Asians, the Chinese in particular, have taken no action to control the outbreak. I mean, what are they going to do? Kill every migrating bird? You'd have to basically wipe out the species. In the British journal Nature, Yi Guan and his associates reveal that the Lake Qinghai strain was related to officially unreported recent outbreaks of H5N1 among birds in southern China. So the Chinese apparently are covering this up, just like they did the SARS epidemic in 2003, before it got out and they couldn't cover it up anymore. And now you've got folks in India who are very worried about this. Tibet, Mongolia, Siberia, into Russia. And by the spring, these birds will be migrating into Europe and the United States, or at least birds that share the same wintering grounds. This virus will be migrating into Europe and across Alaska, across Canada, into the northwestern United States. And there's and into the northeastern United States as well. And a lot of concern about this. There is one drug that appears it can stop this flu virus. And those of you who've been listening to this program for a long time will recall back, it had to have been at least 6 or 8 months ago. Because at the time, I remember I was living in Vermont when I did the story. And it seems like it was just, in fact, it may have been a little longer than that, because it seems like it was just before winter set in, it was just before Christmas, that there was a story in the Wall Street Journal that I shared with you about how it was sort of one of these wink, wink, nod, nod things. It didn't say, hey, if you're rich, here's what you can do. What it said was wealthy people, affluent people, are asking their doctors, or people who have the ability to do so, who have the means, are asking their doctors to write them prescriptions. Right now, asking their doctors to write them prescriptions for Tamiflu, which is a drug made in a single factory in Switzerland by a company that Don Rumsfeld used to be the president of. Anyhow, the wealthy people are asking their doctors for prescriptions to be filled right now for Tamiflu, because this is the only drug that can stop the flu virus that may become a global pandemic. And now we find that Great Britain, and then about, 2 months ago or so, I shared with you another story from the Wall Street Journal saying Tamiflu stocks in the United States are now exhausted. It's too late now. There is no more. And in fact, France and England, the United Kingdom, and several other European countries have placed such large orders for Tamiflu, millions and millions and millions of doses, with Cyril, I believe the company is, that makes it, that the Swiss factory is going to be manufacturing for years before they can get around to filling any more orders from the United States. It's too late now to get it in the United States. At the same time, the British government is conducting emergency simulations of a pandemic outbreak. It's called Operation Arctic Sea. And they are scouring the countryside for places for mass graves of humans. Where can we bury 1 million people, 2 million people, quickly? The British are working on this right now. The Canadians are working on this right now. Bill Frist gave a speech at Harvard in June. As this article notes, referring to Washington's failure to stockpile an adequate supply of the critical antiviral oseltamivir, or Tamiflu, Frist sarcastically noted that, quote, quoting Bill Frist, to acquire more antiviral agent, we would need to get in line behind Britain and France and Canada and others who have tens of millions of doses on order, end quote. And they have developed, apparently, a vaccine that may be effective against this flu. However, it takes two doses plus a booster. And it's going to take a while to develop it, and we don't know if it'll actually work or not, because the flu actually hasn't infected any humans. Our government finally ordered 2 million doses of the vaccine from the pharmaceutical giant Sanofi Pasteur, enough for 450,000 Americans. As one researcher told Science magazine, quote, it's a vaccine for the happy few. The Bush administration's bought enough flu vaccine for 450,000 people. I wonder if that's like the top level of the donors to the RNC. The same thing with Tamiflu. As Bill Frist pointed out, Roche is the company that makes it. We now have to stand in line. They point out, moreover, the majority of the world, including all the poor countries of South Asia and Africa, where history tells us pandemics are likely to hit especially hard, will have no access to expensive antivirals or scarce vaccines. It is doubtful whether the WHO will have the minimal pharmaceuticals to respond to initial outbreak here in the United States. Recent theoretical studies by mathematical epidemiologists in Atlanta and London have raised hopes that a pandemic might be stopped in its tracks if 1 to 3 million doses of Tamiflu were available to douse an outbreak in a fail-safe radius around the early cases. After years of effort, however, the World Health Organization has only managed to inventory 123,000 doses of Tamiflu. People just don't get it, said Dr. Michael Osterholm, the outspoken critic of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He said, if we were to begin a Manhattan Project-type response tonight to expand vaccine and drug production, we wouldn't have a measurable impact on the availability of these critical products to sufficiently address a worldwide pandemic for at least several years. As Shugeri Omi, the Western Pacific director of the World Health Organization, told a UN meeting in Kuala Lumpur in early July, we are now at the tipping point. Somebody needs to let the Bush administration know. I would suggest that you call your senator and simply ask, what are you doing to protect your state from an outbreak of bird flu? From an epidemic outbreak of bird flu. What are you doing? And you can reach them by calling 1-877-SOB-USOB. It's a toll-free number for it's the old Senate office building, a toll-free number for Congress, 1-877-SOB-USOB. John in Pittsburgh on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better, John. What's on your mind?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a great country to live in. The flus and the medical care we have in this country is great.
I know. We've got a lot of work to do, John. That's why we've got to get started.
We got tons. I mean, everybody talks about, you know, we have the worst health care. You know, everybody in this country has health care and coverage. If you're sick and you go to any hospital, they have to take you.
Yeah, and you might be wiped out for the rest of your life financially, and you can't declare bankruptcy anymore, but they got to take you.
Exactly. Well, at least.
Isn't that wonderful, John? Is that your point?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks a lot, John. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, what's on your mind today?
Well,
Tom, regarding the bird flu, and I want to even bring in the single-payer health care thing, I am for single-payer health care, but I'm more concerned about our reliance on Big Pharma for our health care. Do you think Big Pharma can really solve this problem, or is it too late, you know, to look into nurturing our immune systems, or is this looming threat a natural check on overpopulation?
All of the above. It is not too late. I mean, you know, keeping your immune system in good shape is always a good thing. As I said, my grandfather and grandmother survived the flu epidemic of 1918. In fact, all of ours did. That's why we're here, right? So it is possible to make it through these kinds of things. It's going to take some work here, I think. And now is an important time for us to be saying to the government, hey, wake up. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Thanks, Bonnie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Let me add in response to John, we do not have the best health care system in the world. We don't. By any objective measure, we do not. By infant mortality, by adult mortality, by lifespan, by access to health care, by the speed of health care, we don't. You look at the different criteria and you find that we are anywhere from number 7 to around number 40 in the world. We have the most expensive health care in the system in the world. Absolutely the most expensive healthcare system in the world because it's privatized. The rest of the world has said, you know, healthcare is part of the commons. It's sort of like, you know, the fire department, the police department. It's part of the public good. So, you know, the rest of the world has less expensive healthcare than we do. Canada spends about half of what we do on healthcare. For example, they're, again, by any objective measure, you say, oh, there's Canadians are complaining about their health care all the time. They have to wait in line, quack, 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 quack. I'll tell you, I lived an hour and a half from the Canadian border for 10 years. And not once did we ever hear a single story of Canadians coming to America for health care. Yes, you will hear them in the press. Find one backed up story. On the other hand, I can tell you that every weekend in Montpelier, Vermont, where I used to live, there was a bus that was organized for folks to go up to Canada to get health care. Every weekend. So, yeah, don't give me that nonsense. Cecilia in Seminole County, Florida is on the line. Hey, Cecilia, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great. How about
Good.
You?
I'm fine. Always better when I have you on my computer and listening to your show.
Thank you.
What's my pleasure. I wanted to bring to everybody's attention a very important show that will be on PBS tomorrow night on the show Now, and it's called The Perils of Pesticides. And they're going to be talking about California farm countries and just how we are living in a toxic soup because of pesticides.
Oh, interesting. This is Now with David Brancaccio.
Yes, that's tomorrow. And also, are you familiar, I don't know if you know, that we have, you know, pesticides along with other things are among my passions, and right now in Florida, about 26 miles along the coastline and 20 short, there's a dead zone, 2,000 square miles. We're poisoning our nest, Tom.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a, I thought it was a 7,000 square mile dead zone coming out of the mouth of the Mississippi River as a result of all the agricultural runoff from the Midwest that's coming down the Mississippi,
This
too.
Is off of Florida now.
Yeah, okay, wow, okay.
Have
Cecilia,
a good one.
Thanks, yeah, thanks, good to hear from you. Thank you very much. Oh, it's been a great day. Thanks to Kareth for engineering our program today, to Louise for producing it. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Always great to see you there and interact, talk with you, converse with you, hear you, see you, whatever the hang out with you. We'll be back, and thank you for listening. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. See you then.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.